Well, happy Halloween weekend. Greetings from Chicago, where I am at the studios of WLS, the Big 89. Thank you, Michael, again, for being such a great host here. And thank you to Drew and all the other folks at WLS, as well as all the folks at Premiere that allow me to do this. Came in this weekend, turns out to be one of those amazing Halloween weekends, weather-wise, like 70 plus degrees or something outside right now. It's extremely warm and very crazy. So Chicago is turned upside down. The noise emanating from the streets, it's almost like the Cubs won the World Series. Although they would, that would, I think, probably even be stranger than Halloween, should that ever happen. Congratulations to the St. Louis Cardinals and all of their fans. I would imagine that would include George Norrie amongst them. It was a special week. Talk about being raised from the dead, that Rangers-St. Louis game six. Holy smokes. I didn't think I was going to survive that. I was actually tweeting back and forth with somebody who was following me, who had tweeted, "Are you watching this game? Unbelievable." And that's what it was like. It just was just phenomenal. I kept thinking, oh, they're out. And I always think it's my fault. I always think I jinxed them by watching. I had that weird sports jinx. And so I turned it off. And then I, you know, found out later on that they won. So that all reinforces my belief that I jinxed the teams I like by looking at them. and I was just so, I know that it was tough for Ranger. I mean, for the Texas Ranger fans. And they played a great series. And by all rights, probably should have won that game. But and that game seven, just wow. Anyway, it was a lot of fun and was fun to watch. And I'm sure it still feels like Halloween or like some kind of crazy celebration that's been going on ever since then in St. Louis, going right through Monday. But on Halloween weekend like this, we like to tell stories. And there's no better radio show suited for stories of the strange and unexplained, be they real or imagined, than Coast to Coast. And I will tell you more about all those, the stories that we make up to scare ourselves and the stories so scary that we couldn't make them up, coming up next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. We're coming up about an hour from now. We're going to do a special Halloween show you're going to really love. It's going to stay with you, though, so I just want to give you that warning in advance that the stories contained in the book True Police Stories of the Strange and Unexplained are the kind of true stories that will kind of get under your skin a little bit, not because they're horror stories or because the stories are so bizarre that you think that it sounds like something that came out of an episode of The Outer Limits or Twilight Zone, although there are moments of that in this book. It's because these stories of the strange and unexplained that we'll get to coming up next hour from police officers are so real. That's the part that'll get to you, especially those of you out there that don't believe in the strange and unexplained. These are police officers who are putting their reputations on the line. They sign all these stories. You'll know the name of the cop or the state trooper. You'll know what department they worked in. You'll know that they stand by what they saw, what they experienced, what they witnessed that they still themselves may have taken years to process. We'll get to that coming up next hour with Ingrid P. Dean. She's a detective sergeant. She's the one that collected these stories, as well as having a few in there of her own. And that's next hour, True Police Stories of the Strange and Unexplained, explained for the first time in its entirety. A little bit later on this hour, we'll talk to a woman who's done the definitive work on the Jonestown Massacre. Now, you might remember this from what will be the 33rd anniversary coming up in November, but you have probably never fully understood it until now. It is the complete untold story of hope, deception, and survival at Jonestown. The book is called A Thousand Lives, and we'll talk with Julia Shears coming up later on this hour. Very interesting and, of course, tragically sad in some cases, although there are some amazing survival stories getting away from what I would describe as a real-life Satan, a seductive devil that brought people to their destruction so that they could honor his ego. And that, to me, fits the definition completely. And we'll get to that a little bit later on this hour. Also, let's do a couple of quick news pieces and then fun announcement about a documentary that's out about the Godfather of Gore in just a moment. If you go to coasttocoastam.com, always interesting stories in the news box tonight. However, there's one that's going to be kind of challenging to folks. There's been a massive experiment conducted at a research center in UCLA. It was the first ever experiment to prove that close encounters with UFOs and extraterrestrials are a product of the human mind. Now, to my mind, I think even in the very premise of this, it's overreaching, but we'll get back to that. They took 20 volunteers back in October. They were instructed to perform a specific procedure upon overnight and early morning awakenings over the next few days. And more than half of the volunteers experienced at least one full or partial out-of-body experience as a result. Seven out of them reported making visual contact with UFOs or extraterrestrials. Meanwhile, the sensations they described were identical, say the researchers, to those accounts by, quote, alien abduction survivors. By some estimates, up to 1 million Americans experience such encounters every year. Now, according to the researchers, the term out-of-body experience is used to refer to the sensation of having left the body and not a real exit of some essence from the physical body, although this is just the impression often had by test subjects. So, you know, this is their version of that. It's kind of interesting to see the scientists that we've had on the air who have conducted other experiments, who've been involved with ongoing, massive amounts of data over decades involving hundreds, if not thousands, of patients who have been going through, for example, surgery, who have been able to see and record things that happened in other rooms while they were there on the table, physically being operated on. And yet they were able to tell you things, conversations that happened rooms away. And they were the people that were conducting those experiments were every bit the scientists these are in UCLA. Now, I'm not saying that they're not sincere, but a sample size of about 20, they consider to be definitive. Definitive, 20 subjects, definitive over several nights. I don't know. I'll go with the people who have done hundreds over decades. But the fact that UFOs and extraterrestrials may be deliberately encountered in a controlled manner and within a few days proves to them that such experiences are a product of the human brain. The experiment author is Michael Reduga. He explained, quote, "We tried to right a common misconception with this experiment. The issue at hand isn't extraterrestrials, but hidden human abilities. If you've encountered UFOs or aliens after sitting or lying down, it can now be unequivocally stated that you've had a spontaneous out-of-body experience. We have proven this." Well, you know, that again, I think as I go back to the thesis, I think it's an overstatement of what they've proven, that this is true for everybody because they've proven it with a few people. However, it is an interesting experiment, one that might explain some people's experience. But what about those people who encounter UFOs while wide awake? What about those people who not only encounter UFOs wide awake, but around other people? So it doesn't explain away the UFO phenomenon, just perhaps under some circumstances, under, you know, some particular moments that can be categorized and discussed. And there you go. We'll leave it there for now. Plus, astronomers in space have shown something very different than what we had previously thought. There is an organic substance commonly found throughout the universe that contains a mixture of the aromatic and the aliphatic components. The components are so complex that their chemical structures resemble those of coal and petroleum. And it's in space, coal and petroleum in space. Since coal and oil are remnants of ancient life, this type of organic matter was thought to arise only from living organisms. So how could it be out in space if it comes from living organisms? This team's discovery suggests that complex organic compounds can be synthesized in space even when no life forms are present. Or were they once just so long ago that we don't know where they are anymore? Well, anyway, there's more on those stories at coasttocoastam.com. And while you're there, too, you can also click onto the story of the missing arm of the Milky Way. The missing arm of the Milky Way. They found it, but as soon as I saw that story, the missing arm, I'm immediately reminded of the work of a particular director that we want to talk about tonight. Producer, director, writer, a guy who many people would say is the godfather of gore. Herschel Gordon Lewis, who directed a film called Blood Feast in 1963, and he's the subject of a documentary that's out for the first time on him. And Frank Hennenlotter will join us here because, well, although Herschel Gordon Lewis is alive, he just didn't want to stay up this late. Good evening, Frank Hennenlotter.
How you doing?
Good. And you're a famous director in your own right, as I understand it.
Well, fame and what I do is two different categories.
Okay, well, talk about that.
Well, I mean, you can make obscure little movies and you become a cult director.
That's right.
Different than being famous.
Okay. Well, see, no, I think some of people's most famous films are cult films. What would you say is the film for which you're best known?
Basket Case.
Basket Case. Now, that's just coming out now on DVD, isn't it?
No, it's coming out on Blu-ray.
Blu-ray. Sorry.
We actually did a high-def transfer of that thing.
Okay, because I saw a press release on this, and so it had been out on DVD, but this is... The Basket Case is one of those freaky, weird movies that a lot of people see and can't get out of their heads either.
Yeah.
Yes. You made it. It's the story of separated Siamese twins,
correct?
Right?
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah.
I remember somebody telling me about this in college or something, and it really disturbed me. So,
yeah.
I confess I've never seen it, but Basket Case is one of those movies that got passed around on VHS.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. That's where I think it's. Popularity came from the VHS era, from the home video era. You know.
Okay, and this is the story of a guy who, and we'll get back to Herschel Gordon Lewis in just a second, but that your movie, Basket Case, is just coming out on Blu-ray. This is the story of a guy who brings his living but separated Siamese twin brother around in a little basket?
Yes, yes. It's a little, he walks around with a wicker basket with the little Siamese twin brother who's very misshapen in it. And when anybody opens the basket, he jumps out like a malignant jack-in-the-box.
Okay.
And hits him in the face.
I'm not saying that I won't watch it someday. I just won't. It's funny, but there is that genre of movie, and obviously you're a guy who's perfectly qualified to talk about the work of Herschel Gordon Lewis, the subject of this new documentary that's out. But this is a genre which appeals to some people greatly because they're able to separate out all of the funny kind of over-the-top gore on the screen
right. And
reality. I'm not one of those guys. Sometimes I get, it's like so gross that I think, I can't handle it. But it is, the gore of Herschel Gordon Lewis, the sort of drive-in movie gore of the 1960s, this was intended to be over-the-top and kind of funny.
Oh, very much so. But it was also very intense for the audience. A little bit went a long way in those days, especially on the big screen.
Well, this was back in the days, and I think for some people will remember this better than others. Back in the days before the Film Rating Board, when people like Herschel Gordon Lewis could get away with both the first round of movies that made him famous, the documentaries, wink, wink, about what was happening at nudist camps around the country, these so-called nudie cutie movies. And then after that, they moved it into this bizarre world of the sort of comic, you know, horror gore.
Yeah, well, that's what exploitation was all about. And these were exploitation films. And the only way they could compete with what Hollywood was doing was to give the audience something that Hollywood wouldn't touch. And whether that's people running around in a nudist camp or whether that's excessive blood and gore, that's what you gave the audience. And that's what I came to see.
Right. Well, it's funny. I mean, let's just back up for one second. If we're going to be talking about the godfather of gore, before he became that, he was known for making these movies that he kind of helped pioneer And that's part of the documentary about the Godfather of Gore, is that he really did have this. They found these people who were literally living a nudist lifestyle, and they found a way to get around the censor board by, there's no sex involved, and it's all very matter of fact as people play volleyball and checkers, whatever. It's all very stupid. Right. But these were hugely successful films.
Very much so. And they're, when you watch them today, they're so innocent that you wonder if they could even get a PG rating. They're so they're so clean. But at the time, it was very much kind of the pornography of the day. These right. were very shocking films back then.
Right. Even though shocking meant watching somebody walk up to a pool and get in it.
Yes.
And there
yes.
was no, it's like yes. so unsexy. It's just.
And also, of course, they never used the real people in the nudist camps. Because these were
right.
you know, average-looking people. You didn't want to see naked. So they
right,
always
exactly.
brought in a bunch of very beautiful young girls to do the strolling around. They had to look like modesses and I mean models and actresses
right.
and everything.
That's what was so funny about it. As I was watching the documentary this week, and you can link up to more both of the work of Herschel Gordon Lewis, the Godfather of Gore, but also to Frank Henenlotter, who we're talking about now, about it. That the before Herschel Gordon Lewis made Blood Feast in 1963, he was finding these women who were like church secretaries and, you know, people that they would just encounter who just said, sure, I'll get naked and walk around. I mean, I think they were just as surprised as that on camera, perfectly normal people were willing to just walk around and drink hot coffee in the sun while being filmed for a so-called nudie cutie.
That's right, right. And part of the fun of these nudie cuties, too, is that because there's no sex, but everybody's naked, it's funny to see them doing the most mundane
yeah,
things.
Yeah, that's the thing. Like writing a letter.
Yeah, yeah.
Staring at a cloud. I mean, it's just
yeah,
dumb.
Yeah.
But, all right. But then, like, everybody got into that business, so they had to find a new source of income, and that's what started with the whole over-the-top gore thing. And a lot of the same people that they'd been working with to make these so-called nudie cuties, now they start doing these Blood Feast movies. And Blood Feast is the most famous example. But, I mean, it's really like, this is, when I was in high school, my buddies and I made a movie on Super 8 in the backyard. And we came up with a plot, and there was all sorts of gore with a lot of ketchup. And we got, all of our moms were mad at us because we took all the condiments out of the refrigerator. And we, you know, and we stole food to make brains and what all this. And that's what this is like, almost. I mean, it's just like one step up from a horror movie you'd make in your backyard.
Oh, very much so. I think that's what gives the film its charm, and it's why you have such a good time watching it, because it's so completely unrealistic, except for the violence, which is, you know, which is so over the top.
Right. And yet, you know, I mean, in a way, before they did that movie, there really wasn't a movie. There wasn't a genre like that. And we still have that genre to this day. So he really did create kind of this this style of movie making that some people get it and some people don't.
Well, there really wasn't even a lot of blood in films. Blood was kept at a minimum. Many times horror films that were imported into the United States that had a bit more blood overseas was trimmed here just to keep the blood at a polite level. This really, you know, so here was...
Polite level of blood.
In this world of let's just show a little, if somebody is in a, if something horrible happens, just show a little bit of blood. And here was Herschel. Ripping a tongue out of a girl's mouth.
Right, right.
I mean, it just went way beyond.
It was way, yeah. And some really bad acting in those movies.
Oh, but that's what makes them so much fun.
Well, it's funny for a Halloween weekend especially, so I'll just remind people that movies like Blood Feast and your very own, very famous movie in your own right, Basket Case, are out. People can watch those movies, and in a Halloween spirit, maybe they can enjoy that. And I look forward to seeing the documentary they make about your work. If they have, they haven't already made one yet, have they?
I hope not.
Of your contribution to cinema, but I know someday they will. So congratulations, and thank you so much for jumping in and talking about Herschel Gordon Lewis tonight.
Well, thank you. Glad to be here.
Oh, appreciate that. All right, so that just goes to show you. Halloween night tonight, kind of fun. Some of it real, some of it not. And one of the most real, scariest stories ever has to be what happened to Jonestown. And there's a new movie out that, a new book out that explains for the first time in the greatest, saddest, most amazing detail, the untold story of Jonestown and the Jonestown Massacre. And we'll get to that coming up along with a couple of your calls, too, on the way on Coast to Coast AM. True police stories of the strange and unexplained. I was trying to think, as I was reading this book, whether that's the best title. And I want to propose that true police stories of the strange and unexplained might also need the word miraculous in there. Because, yes, while these stories are strange and unexplained, some of them are just stories of miraculous survival that police officers can't explain. But it is almost like divine intervention. And we'll talk about some of those, too, coming up next hour on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. Happy Halloween! So we'll get to maybe a couple of calls toward the end of this hour. But I just thought I'd throw out the number since it's Halloween weekend. We can all go a little crazy. And going a little crazy was definitely the story of Jim Jones. In fact, it seems disrespectful to even to use that term in the same breath of just thinking about a Halloween weekend. Yet some stories are not fiction. Some horror stories are so real that it does take us years to kind of unpack them and understand what happened. And it's important that we do. With the 33rd anniversary of Jonestown coming up, we're going to be talking about the story behind the expression, if you will. You hear a lot of people say, drink the Kool-Aid. And they don't even know that it originated with the famous Jonestown Massacre. Julia Shears has written a definitive book, The Untold Stories of Jonestown. We'll get to that coming up on Coast to Coast. And then next hour, true police stories of the strange and unexplained with Detective Sergeant Ingrid P. Dean. You're going to enjoy this show tonight. And we'll get to a couple of your calls, too, coming up in just a minute. On Coast to Coast, this is Ian Punnett. The most horrible stories of all time are the stories of the kind of horror that we're capable of doing to each other. And they are stranger than fiction. I was reminded of Jim Jones the other day because people were talking about Halloween masks. And there's always some story of the year which gets played out in Halloween masks. And I remember the year that so many people went to Halloween parties as Jim Jones. We discovered the horror of what happened in Guyana. We'll get to that coming up in just a second. That was the sort of the embodiment of evil, and people were wearing this sort of typical look of Jim Jones one year, and I think it lasted for a couple of years before it faded out to be replaced by whatever the mask du jour is this year. Julia Shears writes about what happened in Jonestown in a definitive book, which is just out. It's called A Thousand Lives. Good evening, Julia.
Good evening. How are you?
Well, I'm so good. And yet at the same time, I was reading about your book because I was jumping on a plane and the book, I'm sure, arrived like minutes after I had to take off. So I'm really looking forward to reading it. And you'll pardon me for not having a chance to sit down with it yet, but I've been one of those people who've been always fascinated with what happened at Jonestown and how this one guy could convince so many people to either commit suicide or commit murder all at the same time. Well, at the same time, it took hours, and I know that that's part of the story of Jonestown. What got you involved in investigating the untold story of Jonestown?
Well, I'm a journalist by trade, and I was actually writing a novel about a charismatic Indiana preacher and remembered that Jim Jones was from Indiana. He started out as a preacher. And so I Googled him and learned that the FBI had found or had released all of the documents that agents found in Jonestown after the massacre. So 50,000 pages of documents and almost 1,000 audio tapes. And that no one had used these documents to write a book, a history of what happened in Jonestown.
Had to be you. And it has to be told, because it's the one way that hopefully we can prevent this sort of thing from ever happening again. But the planets lined up just wrong for there to be a Jonestown.
You know, it was such a singular event. I'm asked if it could happen again. You know, I really don't think so. I have been to Jonestown, and I had better cell phone service there than I do in Berkeley. So Yeah, I really don't think you could isolate that many people to that extent today.
Yeah. It's a very, and isolation is a key part of it. And as I said, you know, one of the remnants of the Jonestown massacre is that we have that expression to this day that a lot of people don't know from which it originates, which is drinking the Kool-Aid. When you say somebody has gone over the edge or they've become a true believer, you say, oh, you've drank the Kool-Aid. And that goes directly back to the Jonestown massacre, doesn't it?
It does. It does. And, you know, actually, it wasn't Kool-Aid. It was a cheap knockoff called Flavor-Aid to begin with.
The people at Kool-Aid have got to be going crazy. It wasn't Kool-Aid. It was Flavor-Aid. And the people at Flavor-Aid have got to be saying, oh, thank God, they think it's Kool-Aid. Yeah, what would the expression be today if you drank the Flavor-Aid? That would, it just doesn't, you know, it doesn't
Gatorade.
Sound. Yeah, the Gatorade. But lest we be too comical about that, it really was true. They really did lace the Flavor Aid, and they had rehearsed this massive suicide because Jim Jones saw this as being a way for him to handle the fact that he knew he wasn't the Messiah, and he didn't want to have to face his people with the truth of what he really was.
Well, the central argument of my book is that he planned to kill his followers for years before Jonestown. I found evidence where he was talking about loading his followers into buses and driving them off the Golden Gate Bridge.
Shut up.
Yeah.
What year was that? What year did he first say that?
This was in 75, 76.
Wow. So two or three years beforehand.
Yeah, and then he actually sent one of his lovers to flight school thinking he would load his followers onto an airplane and crash it into the ocean or into the desert.
Oh.
And she received her private pilot's license and was working on her commercial pilot's license when he thought about Jonestown. You know, you bring your whole congregation to this remote jungle, completely cut them off from the world, and exact the greatest death toll possible there.
What made Jim Jones a mass murderer that we're still trying to understand to this day?
Well, he was obviously a very disturbed individual. He wanted to go down in history, and he would frequently tell this to people. He would say, I will go down in history, mark my words. And he would say, you know, that one of the things that I gleaned from the FBI documents was this woman who kept a daily diary of her time in the church and everything that Jim Jones said. And he made a couple key statements, including in 1975, he said, I love socialism and I am willing to die for it. But if I do, I will take 1,000 with me.
Let's talk about Jim Jones' brand of socialism, because it looks more like despotism or classic sort of just tyranny, sort of almost like a fascist dictatorship or something.
Yeah, I mean, he wasn't the most political person. I mean, really, what got to Jim Jones and what attracted him to the church was the sense of having control over people.
Right.
And, you know, he, whenever someone left his church, would get furious and became increasingly more despotic, as you say, more tyrannical, especially in Jonestown.
Yeah. And we're talking about the life, the untold story of Jim Jones and Jonestown. 1,000 Lives is what it's called. Julia Shears is the author, and the book is just out with this. You know, the weird anniversary of it all coming up in just a few weeks. I think for anybody who was alive during that period, it seemed inconceivable that somebody that death at that level could happen. And as you point out, out in such a with so many Americans that had traveled to such a remote place to die in such a horrible way. But it was as though they were completely under his spell. And if they weren't, that there were enough people around him that were, that made sure that there were very few survivors. How many people ended up surviving from Jonestown?
Well, there was a group that hiked out that day. It was 30-some, actually, who survived. There was a group that hiked out. There was a group that left with Congressman Ryan. And there were also two men who, after the suicide mass murder ritual started, actually were able to flee. So not that many. I guess the thing that shocks me most about my research was the fact that, besides the fact that Jim Jones wanted to kill his followers for years, was all of these notes from people in Jonestown to Jim Jones saying, please, let me go home. I hate it here. I'm miserable. My children are scared. Just please, let us go back to the United States. I'll do anything you want. And it was obvious from the get-go that people came down there thinking they were going to, you know, participate in this great socialist experiment and that they could go home at any time. Well, they get down there. Jim Jones takes their passports, their money, and says, nobody is leaving. So you go down there. People take a couple months off from work. They send their kids down for a semester abroad. Next thing you know, that it's, no one's going home. And he's rehearsing them, telling someday we're going to have to commit revolutionary suicide.
Revolutionary suicide.
Yeah.
I mean, this sounds similar, eerily similar to what happened at Waco, too. Have you drawn much of the comparison between, say, Jim Jones and a David Koresh?
You know, I was really focused on the amount of documentation that I got from the FBI.
Sure.
So I really focused in. I wanted to tell the story of the rank-and-file member that decides, yeah, you know, I'll go check out Jonestown for a couple months. I don't like it. I'll come back. I'll go down for the summer.
Sure.
Not realizing what Jim Jones had in store for them. So the way I structure the book, I follow five people through Jonestown. And, you know, you don't know until the end whether they live or die. But, you know, what attracted these people to Jim Jones? And what happened to them when in Jonestown? What was their life like there? And when did they have the realization that the man was evil?
Well, he sure was that. And I'd be curious if you ever did look into the David Koresh thing, because so many of the things that you speak of, that idea that nobody's getting out of here alive, or that you are all under my control, or other aspects of that story seem eerily similar to the kind of control that David Koresh had and ended, at least in some respects, just as tragically, although there was obviously the government involvement in the case of David Koresh, and the government involvement in the case of Jonestown was that a congressman showed up to investigate, as you had mentioned. Somebody came down there as constituents had reached out to him and said, you've got to find out what's going on down here. And he was almost gone. He had almost made it onto the plane when Jim Jones retaliated. I want to let you know that there's a woman who is, at least as I understand it, is Jim Jones's adopted daughter on the phone. This is Bonnie, west of the Rockies. And I will just tell you, Julia Shears, I hadn't had a chance to vet this, so I'm going with the folks back at the studio. Hey, Bonnie.
Hi, Ian. And hi, Julia. You and I share a lot in understanding the nightmare of what this was.
Tell me about you are Jim Jones's adopted daughter?
I was called his adopted daughter, and I wrote a bestseller, and I went with the congressman, and I warned him that it was a big facade. I don't want to take Julie's time away from her. I have not called anybody in 30 years, and hearing... There are as many stories as there were people who died, and there were 913 people that died in Jonestown. And Julie, I just want to reach out to you and say thank you for reading this book, or for writing it. Thank you for having compassion. I have so many answers, but I want to hear what you have to say too. So,
well, tell me what you mean by you have so many answers. What do you mean by that?
How Jim was able to lure people into the temple. He masqueraded as a minister,
sure,
who covered up his youth clothing with a choir robe, who did, quote, miracles. articles by calling people out of the audience by their names and saying, have I ever been in your... I hope I'm not...
He was a charlatan. He was... How did you happen to be his so-called adopted daughter? How did that come about?
I lived with him in Brazil. My parents were missionaries. And I loved them because I loved the Brazilian people. And they had little Jimmy, their Afro-American son. They had Lou, their Korean War orphan son. They had Suzanne, their Korean War orphan daughter. And then Stephen, their only biological child. And I lived there with them and loved them. And so that's how I got to know them.
I appreciate that.
Stephen had read something in Esquire magazine, this is way back, saying certain places to hide in case of a nuclear holocaust, and Bellordi's Olsey was one. And I met him accidentally. My father met him at the post office. He couldn't speak Portuguese. And he brought Jim and Marcy and the whole family home. And I fell in love with them. I fell in love with their interracial family.
Right.
And I named both my children after theirs.
Hang on just one second. Julia Shears, this all, I'm assuming, has the ring of truth for you on this?
Yes. Yes, it does. It does. And she's right. I mean, he used a lot of smoke and mirrors. And he reached out especially to African Americans in this country with his message of social equality. So absolutely, this is how he lured people in. And I think the question that still bedevils me is when he was a preacher in Indiana, you know, in the 50s, he was at the cutting edge of the civil rights movement, integrating churches and lunch counters and hospitals. I wonder if he ever had a, you know, an altruistic spirit, or if he realized that there was these vulnerable people out here who were aching to hear his message of social equality, and therefore he was able to amass these followers.
Well, Bonnie, I'm going to ask that they put you on hold and that they get a number for you in case Julia Shears and you should continue this conversation off the air. And I'm grateful for you jumping in and grabbing a line, as you're so kind to point out, too, that we'll just wrap things up here with Julia. But that's so interesting and so coast to coast here, Julia, that here we're talking about something and somebody who's so directly involved with it should be listening. As you got to go through these FBI tapes and the FBI files that were just being released, and this is the first book that uses all of that information, you had mentioned before about how he had discussed about how far back in the story arc of this he'd been talking about creating mass murder or forcing a mass suicide. Other than that, what are some of the bigger revelations that came to you as you started looking at the FBI files?
Well, one of the things they couldn't figure out, you know, a year before the massacre actually happened, he's already talking to the community about the fact that someday they're going to have to commit mass suicide. You know, and the people, of course, are shocked. They're like, what are you talking about? We came down here for a better life. And so I think the depth of his deception, how far he went to control people by not giving them enough to eat, by not giving them enough sleep, by playing his voice, either, you know, speaking over the PA system or playing tapes of himself speaking, just the entire effort to really break them down physically and spiritually. And by telling them that they were surrounded by mercenaries in the jungle who were about to come in and attack them. You know, and then sending his sons out to fire back on the village to make it look like there actually were people in the jungle. So that was surprising.
I totally get all of that. Looking forward to reading it myself. I know it's on my doorstep when I get home. 1,000 Lives, The Untold Story of Hope, Deception, and Survival at Jonestown. Thank you, Julia Shears. And thank you, too, for those people that got stranded on the calls there. Obviously, we had sort of a surprise caller. Very interesting, though. True police stories of the strange and unexplained coming up next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett.